Yeah, thank you very much, Max. There is an advantage and a disadvantage of being the last discussant. The disadvantage is that most of the important questions have been asked already. The advantage is that many of them have not been answered satisfactorily. I am also one of those who have not been satisfied with some of the answers. So what I am going to do is to have 6 points. Of these six, two of them will be questions which have not yet been asked, and the other two will be an attempt to pry some more answers which have not been given yesterday. And the remaining 2 points will be sort of leading to some general conclusions, which I am not going to make myself. Professor Dorf, I think, will take the task, but I am trying to, I will try to lead to that. But the first question, which is to the Western representatives here, how much aware were you of the differences on the other side, the differences among the Soviet allies, during the preparatory talks and even before the talks? Now, of course, everybody was aware of the Romanians, that they were doing their thing, which was different from what the Soviets wanted. But to what extent were you aware of the particular interests that countries like Poland or the GDR were pursuing prior to the preparatory talks, that were creating some problems to the Soviets? I am quoting here from some documents that we have been able to get from the Warsaw Pact side. Eventually, I would hope there would be another book, which more properly would be called the Red Book, the documents from the Warsaw Pact side. It's not yet ready, but I have some notes from that. The Soviets have been referring at one point to efforts by countries like Romania, Poland, and the GDR, which might effectively strangle the baby in the cot, the baby being the CSCE that the Soviet Union was trying to do. What were the Soviets referring to? Besides the Romanian, they were referring to a proposal by Poland in particular that tried to go much farther than the Soviet Union itself in actually proposing a draft of a European security treaty, which then was stopped by the end of 1969 by the Soviets. A rather detailed draft, which the Soviets were afraid could scare the West and eventually derail the conference. There was some concern that the Polish suggestion that the future European security system would include also consultation on demand. Any country could ask for consultation for any reason, which, according to critics within the Warsaw Pact, could be turned to the disadvantage of the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union in particular. Also, the Polish demand for regional disarmament, which was within the spirit of the Rapacki plan, was seen as a danger. If used, it might affect the Soviet Union more than the United States. So these were some of the disagreements that had to be ironed out on the western, of the eastern side. As far as the GDR is concerned, the GDR was also criticized, in fact, fairly bluntly. Semyonov, the Soviet Union's German expert, was speaking of the need to oppose, I quote, extreme Polish, Romanian, and East German demands. The East German demands were characterized as an all-or-nothing policies regarding relations with the Federal Republic. So again, I repeat the question, how much were you, the Western representatives, aware of these disagreements? Did you take them into account in your preparations for the Tripoli meetings, and what conclusions did you reach? Second, were you aware of the improvised nature of the Soviet concept of the CSC? I think it was a common belief that the Soviets had something very definite in mind and were pursuing it. It does not appear so from the documents that we have, particularly about the consultations that the Soviets were holding with the Allies. In particular, the Soviets were undecided about the question of whether there should be a permanent organ dealing with European security. That was originally a Polish plan. The Poles were criticized for that by the Soviets, but by June 1970, Gromyko himself adopted it. But of course, in the end, it was not proposed by the Soviet Union. So that was just one example, I think, of the Soviets not making up their mind or not having a clear idea of what they wanted. As of the end of 1969, one of the Hungarian representatives from the Warsaw Pact meeting was saying that the Soviet Union had no precise plans and ideas regarding either the essential content or the organizational structure, or if they have them, they are not yet ready to reveal them, even to us, their allies. Yeah? So that was my second question. Did you take into account the possibility that the Soviets did not have clear goals, that they were still flexible, but if so, they were trying to influence them as long as they couldn't make up their mind, and if so, in what direction? Now about the still unanswered questions from yesterday. The big question, when and how did the human rights become part of the Helsinki process? Actually, we have to start by saying that up to a certain point, they were certainly not part of the Western program, not to mention the Soviet program, but as late as 1970, demands for free movement and other demands that later came under the rubric of human rights were certainly not part of the NATO program. However, this was not the way it was seen by the other side. I have here a quote from the meeting of the deputy foreign ministers of the Warsaw Pact in June 1970, when a reference is made to the unacceptable demands of the other side, such as free movement of people and ideas, and these demands are seen as NATO demands. Although it was only in 1971 that such demands appear in the NATO communiques. So what really the Soviets and their allies were doing, they were attributing these demands to NATO, whereas in reality they had been coming from somewhere else. From where and when? Well, I think the suspect is the EEC, as has often been mentioned here. And one can point out to certain precedents leading in that direction already in 1969. And here I would have a specific question to our colleague from Greece, because it seems to me that what was important at that time in the EEC countries trying to formulate a common position on a foreign policy issue was the need to formulate that position vis-à-vis the Greek developments. How should the community respond to what was happening in Greece? That was an issue in the spring 1969 of the D'Avignon Committee. And once the idea was accepted that one should take a position on some political issue, then the next step, taking the position on other issues, I think would be logical to take. In the fall of 1969, at the meeting of the Inter-Parliamentary Union, Belgium emphasized the importance of human contacts, movement of ideas, and so on. Now, all this was happening before the preparatory meeting of the CSC started, but I think helps to explain why, once it started, one could already build on something. So I am mentioning it here to invite further comments by those of you who are more knowledgeable as time witnesses to help identify of just how the human rights issue was introduced, or more precisely how it crept into the Helsinki process by the time it started. My fourth point, I asked a question yesterday about military detente, and much to my disappointment, nobody reacted. I tried to suggest that according to that Brezhnev statement that he made in early 1972 at the Political Consultative Committee meeting, the concept of the introduction of the issue of military detente was in some sort a Soviet response to the so-called unacceptable demands of the other side. Well, since we didn't get an answer from our Russian colleagues, we can speculate perhaps that the Soviet demand for military detente had to do with the desire to convince the NATO publics that the Soviet military threat was not what they thought, but it was diminishing, and consequently make NATO less capable of pushing the human rights agenda because of the pressure from the public opinion. And it is, I think, significant, and has not been mentioned here yet, that at this very time, Brezhnev in particular indicated to the Allies a Soviet willingness to consider conventional arms reductions, that is to say the VFR, even before it started. He emphasized the need for that within the framework of military detente, but he ended his speech in 1972 by saying that we cannot yet do it. The situation was not yet ripe for that, so it didn't really happen. So that is my fourth point, and now the remaining two leading to some kind of a general conclusion. Once the final act was signed, were the Soviets aware of the potential danger that it represented for them? The danger that we are all aware that the tables would be turned on them. Well, they were not entirely unaware. I have a nice quote here from a conversation Brezhnev had with Gierek, the Polish leader. Brezhnev told Gierek, We have to make these embraces, but must not forget where we are going. We must outwit the devil, not the devil us. So there was an awareness of the danger. But we have also here the testimony by Dobrin, not to be always taken at his word, but nevertheless saying that once the final act was signed, the Politburo was stunned by it, supposedly negotiated by the foreign ministry and too complicated for the Politburo members to understand. Realizing the danger. Again, I would like to ask those, particularly from the former Warsaw Pact side, to address themselves to this notion of whether the Soviets were aware of the danger. Finally, where does it all lead? I brought with me a book which, much to my surprise, many people with whom I talk here are not aware of. I think it is by far the best study of the of our subject thus far. It's called The Helsinki Effect by Daniel Thomas, a political scientist at the University of Illinois in Chicago. I would summarize his thesis and present it to you for discussion. What do you think about it? Is he right? Is he not? Is he partly right? To what extent could he be corrected? Now, Thomas is a political scientist, and his language is that of a political scientist, which is not always the sort of language that, I would prefer, but it is nevertheless fairly comprehensible. And I will read to you the relevant passages and then end. Well, he uses the concept of constructivism, according to which actors, that is to say states, governments, seek to behave in accordance with norms relevant to their identities. Now, what does it mean in relation to the Helsinki process? It means that the emphasis on human rights, originally expressed by the European Community as a key aspect of its internal identity, was externalized in the community's approach to relations with the eastern half of the government, of the continent. That is to say that because of certain domestic characteristics of the European Community, its members acted the way they did, thereby imposing their values on the other side in the process of negotiating the CSC, with the result that for the European Community to succeed in placing human rights on the East-West agenda, both as a fundamental norm and as an area of substantive cooperation, it had to overcome resistance from one superpower, namely the United States, whose foreign policy, at least in recent years, had systematically excluded such considerations, reference to Henry Kissinger, and the second superpower, namely the Soviet Union, whose official ideology and form of rule were incompatible with respect for individual rights. And that what the negotiation of the final act conclusively demonstrates is that although power and vulnerability matter, the social and institutional context of international negotiations can entrap governments in bargains that other interests would dictate that they avoid. So, ending with this quote, I am introducing it and offering it to you for discussion and apologizing for whatever extra time I took to make this presentation. Thank you.